I'ma say what I feel, and I promise to keep it real.
Welcome to the Red Room. Boom, 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 boom.
So you wanna be a rider? Well, you gotta be a rider till your fears are diminished and the doubts are behind ya. It's hard to grind and the business got me stressed. In the Red Room, we let that shit up off our chest. You know the street nerd has got no time for no caca. Sass in class, yes, that's Mr. Bolakaja. Never have to guess when you're listening to Hilliard. He gon' bring more game than a shark playing billiards. It's all about the craft of screenwriting. It's exciting when you turn an outline into something enlightening. Your pen and words are like bullets in a gun. Write what you feel, say what you want.
Welcome to the Red Room.
What's up, y'all? It's your boy, Hilliard Guest. You can laugh, Jeffrey.
Sorry.
We're going to be silly today. It's your boy, Hilliard Guest, and you guys are listening to the Screenwriters Rant Room, mm-hmm. where we keep it street.
Yes.
We keep it opinionated.
What?
We keep it what?
2015. Sorry.
So, Jeffrey.
It's 2000.
We've been doing this for like a year and a half. This bitch, every week is like, what is it?
My mind is thinking of 2016. And when you were saying it, my mind was like, wait, it's 2015. Isn't it? I'm losing track
in
of time.
In about 4 months.
I am losing track of time, people.
You'll be good in 4 years.
It's that summer. It's that summer break. And like, I don't know what days it is. Like, they run into each other. I'm supposed to be places like, what day is this? What year?
You're ahead of your time.
Thank you.
Don't tell her that.
Thank you. Okay. Futuristic.
Don't encourage her now.
Here we go.
So, check it out, you guys. On the Rant Room, we discuss entertainment, TV, film, music, culture, but our focus is always screenwriting, stories, craft, and shit like that.
Shit like that.
So, you guys hear her voice. That's my girl. That's Lisa Bolakaja.
Hey.
What? Why are you excited today?
What a do, fam?
What a do?
It's been a minute. I haven't seen you for a couple of weeks.
It's only been 2 weeks.
That's a long time being away from you, Hilliard. When I'm separated from you, and because you're so busy all the time.
Do you spend your days just mooning or something?
No, you know what I do? This is how I spend my days. I get up in the morning. Mm-hmm. I walk for 3 miles. Early, because you know I'd be hot as hell nowadays. You know, I'd be getting up 7. Then I go and I lounge at the beach, and I read and I write. Then I go to my coffee shop, and then it's hot as hell, and then I have to go back to the beach. And read,
so
and nap.
What's your life?
And, oh, my God. This is the time.
She's just off for the summer.
I'm off for the summer. And here's the thing. When you're off for the summer, you could actually pretend like you're one of the Kardashians and act like you really have some money. Because you're just like, oh. And like when I drive by and I see the people going to work, I'm like, oh, those plebeians. They have to go work. Oh, the workers. Exactly. Hey, did you hear the news? I just read it right now.
What happened?
Because you know, a couple weeks back. Mm-hmm. When I predicted on this show.
She always throwing out some damn predictions or some sort.
When I said Straight Outta Compton was going to make $60 million. You know, and that was on a Saturday.
First weekend.
I said,
you
remember,
said 50, I think.
No, I said 60. Good. No, I said 60. 50. No, I didn't. Go back. No, go back and listen. Go back and listen to the audio,
you,
people.
I went back and listened, bitch. It's 50.
No. I said they were saying 50. I said it would.
You might have said that.
Yeah, okay. I said it would. I said, you know what? I would be surprised if it did not hit 60 million. Yeah. That was on a Saturday. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Of course,
it
hits.
So here's the news today. It is about 150 million now in a week, and it's the number one in the history. In the history,
it's doing your type of numbers. Look at that.
It's the number one biopic, musical biopic in the history of film.
Even over white people's biopics?
Even over white people's biopics. Yes.
Really?
Yes. It was in Variety. I was like, I knew it. I knew it. And we talked about those factors, but I'm just excited. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, and those of you who read my critique on Bitch Flicks, you know, I went in.
You went in.
I said some things. That were truthful. You know, I called NWA. What did I say? I'd say NWA as messenger, mm-hmm. myth, and erasure. Mm-hmm. But it's still a good movie worth going to see, and I enjoyed it in terms of the storytelling.
Well, you said it was one of the best.
It's one of the best biopics I've seen in terms of, like, for as long as it freaking was.
Have you seen it, Jeff?
I haven't seen it. The funny thing is, I've been traveling because we just were finished shooting a film down
like
in San Antonio.
Like he got a job or something.
No. But the funny thing is, when I saw the preview, because I'm... When I heard about the movie, I'm like, I'm not sure if I want to see it. But then a lot of my friends were involved in it. Mm-hmm. And I saw the preview, and I'm in the theater. I'm like, I got to go see this movie. Mm-hmm. And most previews don't make me do that. So it's on my list. And my friends that were involved, I will go see it this week.
No, it's good. Just want to throw that in because it's like, that's huge.
That's historic.
It's huge.
It's historic.
And you know everybody and mama trying to come out with their biopics now. Like, who else waiting? Let's dust off that JJ fad and everybody.
Can we do my Sylvester one,
can
for
we
God's
do,
sake?
Thank you. Can we? Yeah.
I've been trying to sell Sylvester one forever.
Oh.
So anyone out there, fabulous, fabulous script about Sylvester. If you don't know who Sylvester is, go kill yourself.
Or Wikipedia.
Gargle some Legos. Or go to Wikipedia if you need to. Anywho, I thought I'd
Google him, bitch.
I just want to throw that out there. That's all. Anywho.
So y'all see how we do it on a rant room. We just silly as hell. Mm-hmm. So if you guys are grown, let's get it in. Mm-hmm. So today we got a kick-ass guest for you guys. I've been trying to get my man on for a minute now.
It's been a year, hasn't it?
At least. Oh. We've been talking about it. Like, yeah. Running to him and like, yes. You don't want to get you on the show. You don't want to get you on the show. So anyway, thank you to my man Scotch Ellis Loring.
No.
Who reminded you, going, hey, man. Yeah. What?
Go ahead.
No, what you was going to say?
She thought you were going to call me Scott.
Yeah, I was
but
like,
you
this
were
is Jeffrey.
Saying Scott. Yeah, right. Oh, no. But
you're okay. Go ahead.
But she caught herself. But Scotch introduced.
Yeah, he's coming up next. But
yeah, so yeah. Scott said, "Hey, you know, Jeffrey, don't forget this dude wants you on the show." Anyway, so we got my man here, Jeffrey Reddick. If you guys don't know who he is, I'm gonna say this to you right now: Google him, bitch. Google him. We're silly, I
that's a word. That's a word for the day. Just Google. We're just not going to tell you. We're not going to tell you anything about anybody. We're
actually,
just going
to
Google.
I don't really go over people's bios because I want people to learn your journey.
Right.
So look them up, bitch. Look them up. But writer, creator, director, producer. I mean, what else you do? Horror god. Can we call him a horror god?
You know what? You know what? I love horror. Like, horror is my first love. Uh-huh. And I'm always geeked out when I meet other people who like, because horror is like, you know, it's an acquired taste. Not everybody can handle it.
Nobody takes it seriously.
Yeah, and the different levels of horror that there is. So it's like when you get somebody who freaking wrote Final Destination,
okay.
It's like, y'all need to recognize people.
Okay.
Recognize bitches.
Day of the Dead. Can we keep going?
Should
we keep going?
Okay.
Okay, how many of y'all did? 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 of them?
Five Final Destinations. So yeah, I wrote the story in the first draft of the first one and the story for the second one, and they've kept going. So
we'll get into that.
It's had been two really, my favorite actors in there too.
No doubt. Mm-hmm. We're gonna go deep into that.
Yes, because I have some things, some notes and things, talking about horror. So while I have them here,
nothing is off limits. Okay. I always say that.
Good.
Because, like I said, I grew up in a trailer in Kentucky, so I don't, and I'm proud of it, and but also, I just tell it like it is. I really do, because I don't think
it's real talk.
I don't think you know, especially when we're talking about screenwriting. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people want to put on like the best face about everything and this stuff. It's a struggle. This business is a struggle, and I've been in it since I was 19. My journey started when I was 14, but I started working at New Line Cinema when I was 19, and it's been like, I'm 46 now. Who am I going to try to kid?
Y'all need to do it like Japan. 40, exactly. 40 is when you're still a toddler.
By the way,
you don't become an adult till you're 80.
Speaking of horror people, we have this little thing that we do. Lisa does it. What do you do about once a year around Oscars? Where we talk about who are the vampires in Hollywood.
Because some of y'all bitches.
This bitch over
here. Oh, I'm telling you. I'm telling
like
you.
19, don't
trying to, trying to pretend like I'm 40. Like, you know, you 300 years old. Been here a long time, looking fabulous. He's added to my list of hashtag vampire. Exactly. Angela Bassett, all those peoples. All of those peoples.
So let's go into your, you were starting to talk about Kentucky. So since we're talking about Kentucky, let's just talk a little bit about where you came from and how you got into the game.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was actually born in Florida, but I grew up in Eastern Kentucky, Jackson. So I always just claim Kentucky as home because that's where I grew up at. And how I got into the business was actually kind of a happy accident. Huge horror fan. I started watching horror films when I was like 11 years old.
God bless you.
Much
your
to my mother's
God,
well,
no.
Much to her chagrin, but she would let me do it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you
because
Lisa
that way
and
too.
I had mothers that let us watch it.
Yeah, you know? But because what happened is it was me, my friend Calvin, Tony, and Jason. We used to always get together, and there was an old drive-in, and Tony's dad had a big old pickup truck. And so when we couldn't afford to actually go see it, we would just sit on the truck and turn the CB on and listen to the audio of the drive-in.
Oh, God, awesome.
And I remember saying we would just watch it all the time. And we saw One Dark Night and Nightmare on Elm Street as a double feature at the drive-in. And Nightmare on Elm Street blew me away. Mm-hmm. So this story, I know it's on Wikipedia. You probably have heard it before, but
tell the kids who don't know.
Yeah. So I went home and I banged out a prequel idea for Nightmare on Elm Street, and it came out on video. So I looked on the video box and found out the company that put it out, and I called information in New York. And again, this is 14-year-old hillbilly. He doesn't know anything.
No. And this is the old days, people. Before
this is all the internet.
Yeah.
So I had to call information, and I called it and got the name of the company and got their address. And the president and I emailed him a copy of my treatment. And isn't Bob Shea, who I, you know, created, you know, one of the best studios in the world. And he wrote me back and said, we don't accept unsolicited material. So, you know, I'm 14-year-old. I don't know any better. So I wrote him back, and I'm like
1984, 83 or something.
I was 84, and I was like, and I wrote him back, and I'm like, you know, excuse me, Mr. Shea, but I've seen 3 New Line movies, and I spent about $3 on your stuff, so I think you can take 5 minutes to read my story. Yeah, I didn't know any better.
Wow. You know?
And he wrote me back, and he thanked me for my aggressive introduction, and he actually read the treatment, and he gave me notes on it, said, you know, that I was very creative, but I needed to study and learn the craft more. And I became pen pals with his assistant, Joy Mann, who unfortunately passed a couple of years ago, but she became like a second mother to me. She's just was a wonderful woman, and she would send me like scripts and tchotchkes, and she taught me what tchotchkes meant. I didn't know what that meant.
they don't have tchotchkes in Kentucky.
And so I stayed in touch with her and got scripts and kind of learned through reading scripts, but I was going to school to study theater. So I went to Berea College in Kentucky to study theater, got a short-term study to go to New York for the summer, and got into the American Academy of Dramatic Arts for the summer, and ended up getting an agent, got an internship at New Line. I was like, wow, this stuff is easy. And I'm like 19.
Okay.
And that's where I was then. And then I have to backtrack for a second, because I had read, and I forget who said this. I wish I could remember who said this, but I read somewhere that they said it takes 10 years of really struggling at your craft before you start seeing success.
10,000 hours, yes.
You know, and before you start seeing success. And they didn't mean before you, like, blow up. They meant before you just start making a living at it.
Right.
And the reason behind that I've learned, you know, as I got older, is because you meet some people who are like, okay, I'm going to come to L.A. for like a year or 2 years and give it a shot. And if I don't make it, then I'm going to quit. Well, you know what? You ain't going to make it in 2 years. Right. It takes longer.
Right.
But I was 19. I'm like, I got all this stuff going on. Screw that 10 years thing. cut to, it was 10 years to the year that I graduated that I sold Final Destination to New Line.
Wow.
Because my acting, what happened with the acting thing is, because it was the early 90s, they didn't know what to do with me because I'm biracial. And my agent said that I was an ethnic Michael J. Fox type.
Really?
Which, you know, I love Michael J. Fox.
Yeah.
Loved him. Yeah, still love him. And she's like, but if you rapped or played basketball, I could cast you. But since you don't, I don't know what to do with you.
Wow.
So
pigeonhole and blackness, people. Yeah,
and then they canceled the Cosby Show. So I'm like, well, that was my only chance of getting on TV at that point. So I'm like, well, you know, I'm going to start writing then. And I'll just start writing stuff for myself. And it's taken me a while because, I sold Final Destination when I was 30. So, you know, I'm still writing about killing teenagers, and I'm obviously not a teenager anymore. So I've had to kind of be a little bit more sneaky about writing stuff for myself. Right, but
Can I ask you a question? If you don't mind? When you were working at New Line, you were working at New Line for a long time.
I worked at New Line for about 10 years.
And should you start an intern? Did you work your way up?
Yeah, I started. Well, it was an interesting story because I started off as an intern, and then I'd been there. Because what would happen is when executives, their assistants would leave, they would want me to fill in for them because they got to know me. So they actually created the first floater position at New Line for me. It was an actual full time position where I'd fill in for any executive assistant, you know, that was when their boss.
So
left.
You were around the time where, like, was it Mike DeLuca?
Oh yeah, Mike DeLuca. Yeah, okay. I was at New Line. Like,
a big
yeah,
Mike DeLuca fan.
Oh, I. You know, the thing I love about Mike DeLuca and the thing I loved about New Line at the time, especially, was Mike DeLuca was like fearless. Like,
yes!
So many. He was a film lover, and Bob Shea was a film lover. And they would put out these movies, like, people would be like, well, nobody wants to see a movie with a black vampire killer. That's stupid. Or nobody wants to see a movie about some guy who puts a mask on and, you know, or nobody wants to see a movie about house parties.
Right.
And he would get behind these movies that today nobody would make.
Yeah.
You know, well, maybe some people now would make them finally. But, you know, back then nobody would make them. But he would see the potential. And he would push for them, and they would become huge successes. And
visionary.
He really was. And And also, he actually even wrote me when I was inking, you know, when I, before I started at New Line, too. Like, that was my the biggest thing when I got a letter from Mike DeLuca.
Yeah.
Because he really was a visionary, and he because he's a film lover. And that's the thing that I find that's missing a lot of times now in the decision-making part of the business, because a lot of companies have become corporate, is they hire business people to run this stuff, and the business people don't love film, so they don't quite understand film in the way that, like, a Bob Shea or Mike DeLuca did back in the day. So, I mean, I was at New Line back in its, you know, I think in its creative heyday when they were making Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Oh, I think most of my whole life, teenage years, was watching all New Line Cinema movies.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I mean, like, I can't say, I literally can't say enough good stuff about the company. And it was really sad when it got kind of absorbed in Warner Brothers.
Is that where you learned how to write, reading all the scripts there?
Yeah, like absolutely. I never took any screenwriting courses. Joy would, again, send me a lot of scripts to read. And the thing is that there's two things I always try to tell people. It's like, you can get a film school education, but a lot of times I think sometimes that can beat the creativity out of you if it keeps you so focused. And I know people that have went to film school and spent, you know, they're so far in debt, and they're like, I should have just went right out, especially now with the equipment that they have. Definitely. You should just go out and start making stuff. But I think you learn by reading, and I just, because I loved horror, I just read every horror script I could get my hands on. Like, I, you know, dug through the old files and found, like, the original Nightmare on Elm Street draft, we're just reading all the scripts, and, you know, Wes Craven's a great writer, and so you kind of learn by watching films and reading. So that's kind of where I got my education, and the funny thing is I had written a script.
That's the best training.
It's the best training. When I was young, like, I wrote this script, but when I was like 16, like, and I sent it off to New Line, and it was about a biracial kid growing up in the prejudiced South, and you know, blah blah, you know, just very on the nose biologic and autobiographical. And the development executive, her name was Melanie Backer, wrote me back, and she's like, "Oh yeah, it got really good coverage, but it's not right for us." So when I start working at New Line years later, I read the coverage, and the coverage was like, "Well, this wouldn't pass muster for an after-school special. It was obviously written by somebody in middle school." And I was like, I was in high school. But the lesson is, if I had heard that with my first project out, I would have been like, oh, I'm horrible, and I would have dropped out of the business.
Fold it,
so the thing is you have to realize that you're always growing. And once you get to the point, like, I meet a lot of the thing that frustrates me the most is I'll meet a lot of young writers who are like, you know, they've written their first script and they think that, like, they're the best writer already. And they don't want to hear notes and they don't want to hear anything. And it's like, you know, the best writers that I know are still the ones that send their stuff out to get notes from people and listen to people, because the minute you think that you're at the top of your game and you can't get any better, you stop growing as an artist. You know, so I think you always have to be open to constructive criticism. And you have to realize that movies are a collaboration. And unless you're going to direct your own movies and produce them, unfortunately, in film, you can't be precious. Like, you know, it's weird going from a theater background where the play was like so important in the foundation of everything to and movies in the words that were on the page and what William Shakespeare wrote.
Writers are regularly like, well, we're going to change all that.
Whereas when you
theater.
Right. And then you get into the movie business and they're like, well, the script is a rough blueprint of, and it's like, well, okay. But then you get into television and then they're very faithful to the writing, even though there's it's a more collaborative writers room process. But once the script is done, like, you know, the director comes in and they're hired and the actors are hired to say the words, whereas in film it's like they buy your script and they're like, we're going to do whatever we want to with it now.
You're not even coming on the set. Think about it.
I've been fortunate. I've been on the set of every one of my films. I have to say but I've always had to be very, like, make it very clear that I'm coming on as...
Can I ask you a question?
Of course.
If you don't mind.
Of course.
Is that because your first experience came from the same company you worked for? Do you think that helped? And then you became producer level immediately?
No. I think what happened on the first film, you know, they invited me on set and got me a cameo. Actually, there was some.
You're like a cop or something?
No. You didn't. You don't see it because that was the only scene that never actually made it to the DVD extras. There was a misunderstanding between. No, I mean, I'm being as polite as I can be.
What happened was
a misunderstanding between the director and me for some, and it really was ridiculous. I mean, Bob Shea basically had me giving notes on the director and his writing partner like every draft that they did. Okay. But nobody told the director this. And there was an issue that came up with, there were some gay jokes in there that were like in the first 30 pages were like three of them. Mm-hmm. And they just kind of stood out. And one of them was at a memorial service. There was mm-hmm. a gay comment and it was just like ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And so it kept kind of going back in the studio notes to like take them out. But every draft kept coming back with them in. Mm-hmm. And so finally I just emailed Bob Shea directly. I'm like, dude, this is ridiculous. Like mm-hmm. this stands out and it's homo. I mean, it's offensive.
Right.
And what happens if I'm giving press and somebody asks about it? And what am I going to say? I tried mm-hmm. to get him. So apparently Bob faxed that or emailed that email directly to the director who had no idea that they were giving me every draft of the script to give notes on. So the director got really pissed off. I went to set to visit, you know, set and shoot a camera. I'm like, and I come back and I tell the producer, I'm like, wow, they weren't very friendly at when I was out there. He's like, well, they really don't like you because they, you know, they mm-hmm. thought, you know, feel like you were going behind their back trying to sabotage the movie. Or I'm like, what? Yeah. I'm like, did anybody tell them that I was getting the scripts to give notes on? And mm-hmm. they were like, no, we didn't want to upset the director. And I'm like, oh, well, great. So then,
well,
the,
so, now it's thank you.
So now it's my fault. The director, like, you know, again, like literally, I mean, they shot this whole scene, mm-hmm. you know, in the airport security. And like mm-hmm. There was a whole set.
Right.
And it's the only scene that didn't make it on the DVD extras. Mm-hmm. And they also tried to cut me out of the commentary, which was funny because when you work for the studio, it's like, I had a friend just call me up and say, hey, they're doing the DVD commentary today. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, really? So I call Bob Shea up. And Bob's like, what? Give me a minute. He hangs up the phone. Like 5 minutes later, I get a call. Oh, we want to record you for the DV commentary. Like it was,
oh my God.
It was.
So, can you come in 5 minutes?
Okay, can you come in 5 minutes?
So that's why, you know, I talk about this story because, again, I, you know, you always try to, you know, people want to put the best face on everything. Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, you don't. Unless you are kind of realistic about your journey, mm-hmm. you're not helping anybody else. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? So with Final Destination, like we actually had a premiere in my hometown, which was wonderful. But the reason we did that was because I didn't actually want to go out to LA and I didn't want to cause any friction mm-hmm. for the whole team out there because, again, nobody had kind of told the director that. Nobody
you're
had
so,
even cleared.
You're so nice about
nobody
it.
Had cleared the air by then.
You're
well,
so nice. Like I just don't want to cause you. I'm like, bitch, I've been out there.
Well,
deal.
I wrote it.
Okay, deal.
But you know, I got a premiere.
Give me on my
I got
left.
A, I got
on
a
my left.
But I got a premiere in my hometown, and my mom sweet. Got who you know my mom and whole family in hometown aww. Got to come see it. So that you know we handled it really well, and mm-hmm. and again, I'm really proud of the franchise, and Craig, I always have to give Craig Berry a shout out. He probably gets sick of me bitching about the cutting room. See it and all that stuff, but again, I got to keeping it real. Yeah. But I got to give a shout out.
Let me just back up one more time. I apologize.
That's okay.
Because we got to talk about how it even came to you.
Yeah. Like,
oh yeah.
Was it? Did you? Was it an original piece that you wrote, or was
it was
something?
An original?
Okay.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
okay.
And
what I want to know.
What
yes.
happened? Yeah. Because Wikipedia, it's always funny how things. You know, if it's on Wikipedia, it must mm-hmm. be true. But the original concept came to me when I was going everything. When everything relates to me going back to Kentucky for some reason, but I was going back to Kentucky and I read an article, I think it was in People magazine, about a woman who was on vacation in Hawaii and her mother called her and said, don't take the flight home tomorrow. I have a bad feeling about it. Mm. So she changed flights and the plane crashed. So I read that story and that's what got the germ of the idea percolating.
Mm. And mm-hmm.
and back in the day when you wanted to get an agent, well, you still do, I think, but when you want to get an agent, you have to write a spec script for something mm-hmm. that's already on TV
right.
because they want to know that you can write other people's voices.
Right, right.
So I love the X-Files. And so I used the idea as a setup for, you know, I had Scully's brother have a premonition, mm-hmm. you know, and so I used it as a spec script. And I got an agent from it, but I never sent the script to the X-Files because my friends at New Line were like, this is a great idea. You should
right.
do this as a feature.
Fuck X-Files. Okay.
You were thinking it as a TV show at first?
No. I used it as a sample script to get an agent.
Jeffrey,
to get an agent.
Right.
But we never submitted it to the X-Files because my friends at New Line were like, this is a great idea
right.
for a feature. Mm-hmm. Like, don't send it out, like, because, you know, God forbid the X-Files picks it up, mm-hmm. you know, then you've lost the idea.
Right.
But the story for some reason online is that it was a rejected X-Files script, which is not true. We never submitted it to the
right.
X-Files. And so I worked with...
Note to self, let me go back to Wikipedia and change that.
You know,
I was wrong.
It doesn't matter. It doesn't. People just go back and whatever. It's funny. Actually, Mark Kaufman is. I always give him a shout out too because he's the one who was like, "Dude, you got to turn this into a feature." Mm-hmm. And so I ended up two co-workers of mine, Chris Bender and Jake Weiner. No, it was Chris Bender. Ah, crap. Oh, and J.C. Spink.
Chris Bender was Bender Spink. Yeah, yeah.
Chris Bender was a really good friend of mine who worked for Warren Zeid and Craig Perry. So they were looking for horror projects, and so I sent them over like five treatment ideas, and one was for Final Destination. So they really sparked a Final Destination. So we worked on the treatment for months and months and months
how many pages was that treatment?
That treatment was about 12 pages.
Okay, that's not too bad.
And
Not too bad.
And we worked on it forever. The funny thing is, it started off as adults who didn't know each other, but then Scream came out and made teenagers hot again. So then we made them teenagers.
Okay,
smart move.
Yes. But the studio couldn't get their head around the fact that death was the killer. Like, they're like,
you know what? Why y'all don't know film and don't y'all just don't know nothing?
Because they because they were like, you know, how do you can't fight it, and you know, it's just, and so, you know, there was a point. There was a point.
Because nobody wins.
Because you can't really fight it. So we finally ended up selling it to New Line, and I wrote the first draft of the script. And at the end of the first draft of my original script, we did kind of give death an embodiment for a moment, like where you saw kind of this kind of darkish, like, swirling figure, but we never actually, like, gave it a face. And, you know, so I wrote the first draft. They were really happy with it. They went out to directors. They brought James Wong and Glenn Morgan on, and James Wong and Glenn Morgan did a pretty good rewrite on it, pretty big rewrite on it. I just, again, politically, like, if you look at the credits, there's an arbitration process where the Writers Guild looks at all the material,
right,
and they give credits, and they give credit.
You got to rewrite like 60% or something.
Yeah, yeah. It has to be 50% original material to get screenplay credit, and you know, so I ended up with sole story credit and shared screenplay credit. So, you know,
you created the characters.
Well, because a lot of the basic story is still mine. Like, there's, you know, again, like, that's why I always just defer to credits, because there are, you know, it's always funny. You'll always hear people going, well, Jeff didn't, you know, write this. And, you know, even Wong and Morgan were in interviews saying they threw out, like, everything that I wrote because I had a guy hacking up teenagers with a sickle, which is just ridiculous. So I'm always like, just look at the credits, because, you know, there's a whole process. Like, I had, you know, egos were stripped out of it, and it, you know, obviously the story was
the high road.
Can I just ask this? Did you create the main rules? Because a lot of times in horror, you have to have the rules.
Absolutely.
Like, when they threw things out, did they throw a lot of your rules that you had made, or were they already established?
You know what? Because I'm all about being honest. Like, the setup was there, the death killing them in the order that they would have died, you know, the death design was there. The biggest thing that they came up with, and I give them all props for this because I think this helped make the movie more accessible, is they came up with the Rube Goldberg angle, like that something would fall into something would fall into something. They came up with that. In my original version, because again, I'm a big fan of Nightmare on Elm Street, in my original version, since death kind of screwed up, it couldn't just kill them again. So it basically started playing mind games with each character until they killed themselves. So the characters are similar. Like, so in the film version of Final Destination, you know, Todd Hank, the kid that gets hung in the shower, in my version, he basically, you know, he was a preacher's son who was kind of selling drugs on the side. Like, I get, you know, they all had some more backstories. And he felt so guilty after the crash that, you know, his dad's driving home one night and he gets a phone call on the speaker, and Todd's just like on the phone apologizing for being such a bad son and a failure. And his father's like freaking out and he's driving home really fast. And when his father gets home and hits a garage door opener, we realize that Todd's rung a noose up in the garage so that when his dad opens a garage door, he hangs himself.
There he goes, yeah.
So the funny thing is, the movies, there are a lot of similarities. Like, Todd still gets hung, but for some reason, they thought, oh, well, this is our, you know, completely original scene. It's like, no, Todd still just got hung. He just got hung. You know, and, you know, and they had a brother get off the plane and a brother stay on. And in my script, it was a sister that got off the plane and a sister that stayed on. So the thing is, like, a lot of cosmetic changes were made.
Right.
But the Rube Goldberg thing, I do feel really did make it. I think my version was still, I mean, the studio went out with my first draft. They were so happy with it.
Yeah.
Like, it was, because it was very, so, you know, I still love, you know, the other take as well. But, you know, I always, my thinking is, you know, you can always kind of rebrand and say death has a new design and go with however you want. I do think the Rube Goldberg thing was super clever and just made it more accessible, because then people started looking around them for signs.
Right.
So, so that was the thing. That was the thing that they added that I thought was really spectacular. So,
but they still, well, I guess since you had a role in the movie, right?
Well, I just had it. They just shot a little cameo for me.
Okay.
But that was because the studio wanted to do it, and I think that was all set up before things went down the crapper. Like, so they had already had me plan to come out there. But it does crack me up, because it literally was this whole airport hangar, you know, where they're going through security, and that whole scene is just gone now. And it's like, well, you built the whole set, so, and you put everything else on the extras, you're really gonna just let a whole, all that money that you spent on that one scene, just because you're pissed off at me. That's so, well, at some point, I'm sure the footage is out there somewhere. They'll do like a super edition, but that's but I'm funny. Still really, you know, again, I'm blessed, A, that, you know, it's hard to get a movie done in this business anyway. And so I'm so blessed that the concept resonates with people. And, you know, again, that, you know, for any kind of drama, that old drama that happened, you know, like when I finally moved out to L.A. in 2001, like the movie came out, I sold it in 97. It came out in 2000. I moved out to L.A. in 2001. So by the time I'd moved out here,
You weren't fully living here at the time.
Mm-mm. I was in New York, and I was going to stay in New York till 9/11. And I lived downtown, so after that, it was kind of like
time to go.
Bouncing.
It was rough. So I moved out in November of after 9/11, and by the time I got out here, I literally had to basically get a new manager and send my original draft out and go out and meet with all these people because they did not know, even though my name's all over the poster and the credits, because I wasn't out here, you know, pushing
you
it.
Yeah,
I wasn't taking the meetings and taking all the credit for it. So I had to kind of reintroduce myself to everybody, which was fine, you know, because they ended up obviously kneeling and bought my story for the sequel, which I actually really loved too.
So did you have to go back in New Line and pitch it again, or did you?
Yeah, you know what? It's no, it's I wrote. You know what? I wrote a treatment out and. And it's so funny because it's a tough business, you know. And so even though they loved the first one and they loved the script for the first one, they still met every friggin' writer in the town. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And then they finally came back to me and they're like, all right, we're going to buy your story.
Well, when you wrote the first one, did you have in mind like, okay, this blows up? On the back burner, I got the rest of the shit for the sequels already panned out. Or was it like, oh my God, I made it, and oh, now I got to come up with something.
No, you know what? Just because the good thing about New Line was always about branding and franchises. Mm-hmm. So they kind of ingrain that in your head. Mm-hmm. So I'm very, like, concept-driven with my stuff. Mm-hmm. So I always write stuff. I don't do it intentionally, so it'll be a franchise. But I always come up with ideas that I think can be franchisable. So
you have high concept ideas. Just
And when I did the second one, you know, when I wrote the first one, you know, I definitely, when I started on the second one, I wanted to do stuff that I love seeing in sequels, which is I wanted to bring the lead characters back from the first one. Mm-hmm. I wanted to kind of set up a new group of
teams. The ones that survived.
Yeah, I wanted to.
And then when they come back, the second one, then it's real shaky. You're like, you know what?
I don't think they're going to make it.
Yeah.
And I wanted to kind of set up a whole new group of teenagers that you thought were going to be the lead characters, but then I like wiped them all out except for AJ Cook, you know, in the opening.
Yeah.
And then that log truck scene, like that came out of, originally it was going to be a hotel fire, and the producer just kept saying, and that's why, again, shouts out to Craig Perry, because he always pushed me, and he's always just shepherded the franchise, but he's like, you know, it's just not special enough. Mm. And I was, again, driving home to Kentucky one day and got behind one of those damn log trucks, and I pulled into the next lane. And then as I pulled in the next lane, I'm like, log truck. So I pulled off the road and I called up the producer. I'm like, what about a log truck on a freeway? Mm-hmm. He's like, holy, that's it.
It was
that's it.
Brilliant.
And J. Mackie Gruber and Eric Brest did the screenplay for the second one. I wrote the story and they did the screenplay, and they did a great job of really expanding the world. And I think David Ellis, who's passed unfortunately, did such a great job with that sequel. And what they did with the sequel, and again, I'm always about the project, and so if somebody changes stuff for the better, like, I don't care. It's when they change stuff and dumb it down, that's when I get annoyed. But what Eric Brest and J. Mackie Gruber did with the sequel is, my story was very serious in tone because usually studios don't like to muck with anything. Like, they like to keep it kind of the same.
And I like my horror serious.
Me too.
I like it serious, but
you can have some dark humor and some little things in there in terms of character stuff. But for the most part, I don't want yuck yucks. And
you're like, I won't be scared to death.
I just want to be, just give me the thrill.
Yeah,
give me the tension.
And I think they did that with the second one, but they kept it, like, the first one was very somber, like very dark and somber and dreary. And with the second one, it's like, it was fun. It was a thrill ride. Mm-hmm. It was like, oh, you know, like. Mm-hmm.
You guys have more money on the second one.
No, you know what? They spent the exact same money.
What?
It looks like.
Because that log scene alone.
Well, that's right. David Ellis was a stunt director and a stunt coordinator and a stuntman for so many years, and he figured all that stuff out.
Yeah. It looks
It's still one of my favorite openings of any movie, like except for Scream. I shouldn't say, yeah, no. I love the opening. I love the opening of Scream. I love me some Wes Craven and Kevin Williamson and that Drew Barrymore. I will watch that opening scene.
When you just like, oh, Drew Barrymore's she's not in this movie no more.
I saw that at a screening before it came out, so I thought she was a lead. So
that whole we're doing the old Psycho moment where it's like, oh, you think she is, and she's gone.
Yeah. So with the second one, it was great because we got to expand on, you know, the whole idea that the characters who were alive in the second one that were going to die in that freeway pileup, the only reason they were alive was because the people had cheated death in the first one.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a connection between the characters.
Right.
So we expanded on the world. We brought the original characters back. I threw a twist in there again where you set up the characters that you think are going to be the main ones and you kill them. So that was a lot of fun playing with that story.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think the screenwriter is really
kind of like the teaser in your TV show. You set it up every week. This is how it's going to happen.
Right. Yeah. It's been great. And, you know, and I'm proud of the franchise. And, you know, I think the last one was amazing. And
can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
How did you go from writing the first one to the second one, getting the story by, and then getting the executive producer? How did you get the executive producer credit?
Well, with the second one, they wanted me. I was working on this TV movie called Return to Cabin by the Lake. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about that in a minute.
You know?
We'll talk about that. No. I think. But they said, we want to buy your treatment, but you know, we want to work with these, you know, have these guys write the screenplay, but we want you to be involved, you know, in the development process and everything. So we'll make you an executive producer on it. And I'm like, hey, you know, that's fine. You know, and so it was a lot of it was more so that I could just kind of oversee stuff, but they did it, you know, they did a bang up job with the movie. The script turned out great. It's actually, I hate to say it, it's my favorite one. And it's my favorite one partially because there wasn't any other drama involved with it. You know what I'm saying? Like it's hard to personally separate stuff, you know, every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just such a fun movie. Mm-hmm. Like from that log track, everything. It's just such a fun.
It's a ride.
Mm-hmm. It's a ride, and that's how I like my horror. Like I want it to be a fun ride. So the second one's actually my favorite.
He said it.
You know what? I understand it because it's kind of like with Aliens. Mm-hmm. Like I love how the first Aliens was like really like dark and hard, but in the second one it became like an action thriller. Still keeping the concepts from the first one. So I can see where it's like, yeah, you can have that. And then why don't you keep that? Just keep the yuck yucks at a minimum for me.
You are like, no yuck yucks.
I just, you know. Rural, yeah. And to me, that's what ruined. I'm sorry, Wes Craven. I'm sorry. I have to say it. That's what ruined a lot of the Nightmare from Elm Street later incarnations. Yeah. It was just like.
It started getting really
when you start, when you, yeah, when your boy.
Mm-hmm.
Starts becoming camp just to see how funny and how many zingers can I get in there. It's like, you know what? You're not the same dude whose arms were stretching out with razor blades, who scared the crap out of me, who gave me nightmares like, shit, there's a dude walking around with a striped shirt and a hat burnt up, and he's coming after you, and he can do all kinds of crazy shit and get you in your sleep. And then when it's coming, you know, when it changes from that, I'm like, you know what?
Well, that wasn't Wes, too. That was
changing it.
And you don't understand. And people, that's what always kind of. It's frustrating because I had seen the first one because it was the second run at the drive-in, so it was coming right out to video, so the second one was already getting ready to come out.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, you see that first movie, which and still to this day is one of my favorite. It is my favorite movie of all time because it influenced me as, you know, plus it also got me in touch with New Line, so there's no way to extricate the two.
Right.
And I, you know, I've got to meet everybody involved in the movie. They're all, except for Johnny Depp. He's too famous. Johnny Depp, if you're listening, I want to meet you sometime.
Yes.
But I've met everybody else. I've met everybody else. he's married, yes. But I've got to meet everybody. I got to meet Heather Langenkamp, which was wonderful.
Yes.
And Amanda Weiss, and just all of them. And they're all just in Robert England, of course. I mean, and even like Lynn Shea, who is a teacher, who's been in everything, and I adore her. But... when I saw the second movie, it was so frustrating because it was such obviously a campy, Like, I'm like, why did you go, like, you had one of the most terrifying movies ever, and then you go camp. Mm-hmm. And then it's funny because they have all this gay subtext, which is great, mm-hmm. but then they denied it at the time, and then they blame it on Mark Patton. They're like, oh, it's because the lead actor was gay. And then now finally they're coming out, like, you know, decades later going, well, it was intentional. Yeah, that probe video game, or that probe board game in his closet was put there on purpose, you know, and Bob Shea in a leather bar, you know, and the coach getting spanked with a towel, like, that. Yeah, don't blame it on the actor. I mean, that was, that was in the movie, people.
Right.
But I don't know, that you just can't, that original one will never, you know, that's what I love about Wes Craven, is he's done some of the, you know, the Scream franchise again is another one that just reinvigorated the genre, mm-hmm. and you know, and I've gotten to know Kevin over the years, and he's just a wonderful guy. And it's nice when you meet these people and they're actually good people,
right?
You know, and so, you know, even the Heels Have Eyes and like all the stuff that Wes has done is like, and he's such a smart, intellectual, like nice guy. Mm-hmm. Like, I finally got to meet him.
Right.
It wasn't until they did the remake of Last House on the Left.
Yeah.
And I was at a party because it. There was a chance they did a.
He was at the party stripping, by the way.
No, not me.
He was on a pole.
I was on a pole.
Hey, Wes, how's it going? I want to talk to you about hey.
Well, no, it's funny because I had a chance to meet a couple years earlier because they did a documentary called The House That Freddy Built, and they interviewed me. And as I was walking out, Wes Craven was walking in.
Oh my god!
And I was like, I can't see.
I know.
And I just kept walking. When I was at the party, one of my friends was there, and I'm like, all right, you've got to introduce me to Wes Craven, you know. And so we sat down and we talked for like 10 or 15 minutes, and he was just so gracious and so nice. And, you know, I just told him what an impact the movie had on my life and career. And he's just such a nice guy, and it was just amazing. Anyway, enough gushing about Nightmare on Elm Street.
But what I like about it, because in terms of when we're talking about horror, and, you know, to me, good horror. And I think it's one of the things that Final Destination does that the Nightmare on Elm Street and a lot of movies do with the really good horror is when you establish, and this is important for those of you who are writing horror, please take notes. It is very important that you structure certain rules and you stick by those rules.
Yes.
Because one of the films that came out with last year, It Follows, which is one of my favorite horror films. Is it this year? Maybe it's this year. One of my favorite horror films this year was It Follows. But one of the problems I had with it, towards the end, the rules started changing and shifting, and that kind of ruined it.
That was my issue with Zombieland.
Yeah, it's
Act One was killing, and Act Two was like bang, bang, bang.
Yeah.
It was like there's no fear, there's no.
Yeah.
Oh, well, you mentioned the rules actually on Final Destination. I have to say, because you know everybody is always about, especially when you're at the writing phase, they're like, well, why are these people? Why now? Mm-hmm. And what's this? And so originally, in my original draft of the script, we learned that Alex had the premonition because he wasn't supposed to die in the crash.
Oh, okay.
So, but he got everybody else off the plane, and they were supposed to die. So that, because, you know, because the question was like, well, if he's supposed to die, then why have the premonition, and what makes him special?
Right.
So, you know, I came up with the idea that he had the premonition because he wasn't supposed to die. And they kind of threw that out in the rewrite. Mm-hmm. So it's just like, everybody dies, and, you know, and they started that trend, I think, in the third one. For no reason. Like, it was like in the second one they lived at the end, but then in the third one, on the DVD extras on the third one, it's like, oh, the people from the second one died. So it's like, we didn't even see it.
Right.
So it's like, so theoretically, unless you're a rabid fan who follows the DVDs, you can kind of still tweak the, because in my head it's like, well, why have a movie where you know everybody's just going to die at the very end anyway?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there has to be some kind of hope.
But sometimes, though, even though you kind of expect them to, there's still the fun of knowing how things are still going to play out. Even if you kind of have an assumption like, no one's really going to make it.
Yeah.
But how, to give you an example, the movie Europa.
Mm-hmm.
Is it Europa?
That sounds right. Europa?
It's the one where they go to the moon of Jupiter. I think it came out last year.
Okay.
Where you kind of know going in that everybody's going to die. Like, they kind of let you know in the first, like, these folks didn't make it. And we're kind of going back and looking at their tapes and what they recorded and all of that. But to me, that still worked, even though I knew what the outcome was going to be.
Right.
I still wanted to see how it played out. You know, to me, that was still important, even though, like, yeah, they kind of died. But how did they die? Like, how did that happen?
Right.
So I think there's still ways you can still have those
you can still
happen.
Do that, right.
Yeah.
Let's move away from Final Destination for a second.
That's the only cow I have to milk.
Let's just say this.
I'm kidding.
$750 million over the franchise.
Mm-hmm.
It's not bad.
No, not at all.
Respectability.
Yeah, and you.
To horror.
What are you, probably one of the first people of color who started a franchise like that to make that type of one of them. Who else we got? What's the dude from Underworld? Maybe him.
Oh, Kevin Grievous.
Kevin Grievous. Mm-hmm. And we're like, who else can we think of?
I never even thought about it like that.
There's not that many. And to me, and like, I know people, you know, we
isn't
try
sad
to.
Sad? We can't no, even think.
But like, to me, that to me is such a huge big deal because mm-hmm. one of the things that people are constantly saying all the time mm-hmm. is that people of color, whatever your mixture is that we don't go see these type of quote unquote genre films.
Not true.
And it's like, oh, they don't write that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Yes, we freaking do.
No, we,
yeah.
we do write that stuff. Yeah. It's like you guys have blinders on and mm-hmm. don't understand that we're out there. So it's mm-hmm. like when I showed my mom your picture, she was like, oh my God.
Oh, that's funny. You know, and the funny thing is I actually never even, I just never even thought of that.
You don't think, because when you're in the midst of it, you're like, I'm just doing my thing.
But yeah.
For the representation, people looking outside, looking in, like that's huge.
Yeah.
You know? Well,
yeah, no, that's actually, I never thought about that.
but we don't live our lives like, you know, oh, this is a black thing, this is a white thing. No.
Right.
We're just right.
We're just right. I mean? It's the other people that kind of put that on us right. in a way, which is interesting. But luckily, we don't have to think about it anymore because we're in a post-racial world now.
So they say. let me sit my water.
I'm sorry.
Right.
I'm sorry. I could not.
I've given them 2 years.
I could not
I'm
say that.
I'm praying this is not a phase.
I know.
Because I'm getting more work than ever. So I'm not complaining. However, these motherfuckers. No, I'm kidding. You were starting to talk about that other.
Return to Ken, by the way.
Return to Ken.
No, and the thing is, again, I preface all this by saying I am eternally blessed and grateful that I get to write for a living
yes.
and have had stuff made.
And in a genre that you
in
love.
In a genre that I love. Yeah. And I've got some great stuff going on, too, that we'll talk about in a little
sure.
bit. But, you know, again, it's if especially since we're talking about screenwriting mm-hmm. and we're talking to screenwriters and aspiring screenwriters, it does it. Like, Steven Sesko is a friend of mine. He did The mm-hmm. Grudge and Red. He's done some great. He's mm-hmm. one of the nicest people that I've ever met in the world.
Talk to him too.
He's a great guy. And one thing he told me is like, you know, if I ever get asked to speak to any group, mm-hmm. I always say yes, because if it wasn't for people helping me, like if Bob Shea hadn't responded to my letter. I always wanted to be an actor. Like, that's mm-hmm. my dream growing up was to be like the first biracial centerfold in Teen Beat magazine. literally, I'm like, I'm gonna be hanging on that ladder like C. Thomas Howe with a pair of overalls on.
Okay.
You'll see.
Exactly.
But if it wasn't, but that was my original dream. But I knew I always wanted to work in the movie industry, mm-hmm. and if it wasn't for people, you know, giving me that shot, like if Bob Shea hadn't written back to me and sure. if Joy hadn't have followed up with me mm-hmm. and if I hadn't got that internship, and you know what, I started getting acting work because when I was at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts mm-hmm. Joan Diancheco, who was like a casting director for mm-hmm. that, her daughter, it starts with an N, I'm blanking on her name, I'm so embarrassed now, but her daughter was in the class mm-hmm. and I didn't know it was her daughter mm-hmm. and everybody was sucking up to her because they knew who she was right. except for me, because mm-hmm. I didn't know who she was, and we just ended up hitting it off.
Mm-hmm. She was curious, who's this person I paying attention
to? No.
She was
the sweetest girl in the world, but because, again, just me coming from Kentucky and just being nice and not, mm-hmm. you know, I never did stuff like when I wrote that letter to Bob Shea, I wasn't thinking like some master plan, like, oh, this is going to lead to an internship that's going to lead to them buying a friend. Like, I was just being in the moment, doing mm-hmm. what I wanted to do. But if it weren't for people helping me, but also people being honest with me, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying? Like, because you know, I used to think, okay, you write a movie and they love it, and then it comes out in the theater like 6 months later. You know, like
yes.
I, you know, that's
we
exactly
all,
what
yes.
I think
everybody thinks.
And they still think, and they think that that's what happened.
Well, that's like me when I was younger. When I first started getting in, I thought like, yeah, you sell the movie. Like, I didn't even know the concept that, mm-hmm. you know, when you're a screenwriter, you make a movie, you make your living because you're selling stuff. The concept of there are plenty of people out here who are writing scripts that are getting sold, whose movies never get made, or people who, you know, can make a living who are getting stuff constantly optioned.
I had about
or
six or seven
I had
movies
no idea.
That I was in as an actor.
I had no idea.
Came.
I had no idea
and
that
I had
that happened.
Good roles in them too.
Yeah, right.
With some big actors.
Like my idea is, if you're a screenwriter because you sold some stuff and it becomes a movie, it wasn't like, oh, the hustle is real. And sometimes you have mm-hmm. things that are optioned. It never happens. Like that blew my mind when you find out. Like, what?
Yeah.
That's how it really is.
And I know people. Like, it was funny. Like, one of my old managers was like one time, because he was complaining that I hadn't written anything in it for a while, and I was like, well, you haven't liked any of my ideas. And he goes, it doesn't matter. He goes, I can sell it. And he goes, I can sell it. He goes, it might not get made, but I can sell it. And I said, well, I don't want to have movies not get made. I'm writing movies that I want to get made. He goes, well, I've got clients that are millionaires that have never had a movie made.
And that's
like,
real.
And that's real.
That's real.
And that's real talk. And I'm like, well, that's great, but I'd rather have movies be made and not be made. I mean, I'd rather have movies be made and be a millionaire, but I'd rather have movies get made and not be a millionaire than be a millionaire and not have any movies made, because the whole reason I'm doing this, I don't want, you know.
Right.
I'm doing this because I want to get stuff out there.
Yeah, it's like, you know, training for the Olympics. You know, I want the gold medal on the podium. I want to run, and I want to be on the podium. I don't want to be like, you know, you made the team.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But nothing else ever happens.
You're going to be on the bench.
You're going to be on the bench. But where's the glory in that?
Yeah. Yeah. But with Return to Camp, and that's why I'm dishonest. Like, and you know, nice. I haven't met any people that I feel. I've been stabbed in the back a couple times, but I don't feel any need to stab people in the back. But no, you know, but with Return to Cabin by the Lake, like it was a sequel to Cabin by the Lake that had Judd Nelson in it. And you know, I got the job, and I wrote a very detailed treatment. So I wrote a really good script. We got the director back. We got Judd Nelson back. They were all excited.
Can you just briefly tell the audience what the first movie was about, so they kind of have an idea?
Yeah, the first movie, Judd Nelson played a screenwriter who couldn't find his muse, basically. Mm-hmm. So he rented a cabin by the lake, and he actually was writing a movie about a serial killer who killed women. So he started killing women and throwing their bodies in the lake to get inspiration. Mm-hmm. So he got caught at the end. Mm-hmm. So my idea for the sequel, because in my head I'm thinking, okay, I want to write a part that's going to make Judd Nelson want to come back.
Right.
So the idea was they were shooting a movie based off of his script, and I had Judd Nelson going through various disguises until he wormed his way into directing the movie.
Mm. Oh, really?
Kind of killed the financier, and then he, like, so he got to wear all these disguises, and it was, and they loved the script, and they got the producer back on. I mean, the director back on, and like probably 2 months before they were started shooting, I get a call from the producer who had brought me on, saying, well, the head of the network read the script again, and he thought it was a little too clever for the USA audience. So they're going to bring somebody on in-house to, like, just kind of do a pass on it. And I said,
Are you saying dumbing it down?
That's what I said. I said, you mean dumb it down? And she said, yeah. And I'm like,
I got to interrupt you, if you don't mind.
First of all, you can't pay me to dumb something. Like,
I think I actually did tell her. I said, well, I can dumb it down myself.
I mean, you come from working at the networks. Why do networks do that? Why can't they have you do it? Is it cheaper to have somebody else?
This was back in 2000. So things have, over the years, have changed and stuff like that. But I think probably they had somebody in-house that was just like
Their go-to
that they could pay $1,000 to and just go. So the producer wouldn't send me the script. It was so funny. But I did go down to set on that one too. Was walked in the background and stuff, and got to watch him film and stuff like that. But they literally went through and just dumbed the script down. Like all the every nuance was just gone. Like I had it where the director and the lead actress were dating, so all the actresses were throwing themselves at the director trying to get bigger parts, and he was like, you know, I'm in love with, you know, and he was, you know, which is the opposite of what you would expect in a movie.
Right.
They're like, well, why isn't he sleeping with all the actresses? I'm like, because that's the cliche.
Right.
And so that's what they ended up doing. So they just dumbed that script down.
Well, that's infuriating, the fact that they would dumb something down.
Yeah.
Like, just the make the movie.
It's too smart for the audience. Now if you watch it, you see what they think about y'all.
You see what they think about you.
Well, again, this was 2000, so I'm sure that they don't think that anymore. but if you watch the movie now, like, the director literally shot it like a comedy. Like, there's like weird sound effects and weird like boing noises and stuff. And I assume it's because he got annoyed that they turned the script into, like, you know, they just dumbed the movie down so much. So I had some friends over to watch it, and it's the only time that I actually started almost crying a little bit watching the movie, because I'm like, wow. because they really dumbed it down. Like, and you know, Day of the Dead was another kind of, you know, janky experience where they had hired Steve Miner to direct the film, and they wanted to bring a writer in, and I'm like, all right, well, I know I'm going to get killed for doing this, but at least as a fan, I can write something that's very faithful to the original.
Right.
And so I went in with an eight page, nine page treatment that was very faithful to the original, and they hired me to write it. And the minute they hire me to write it, they start wanting me to change everything. So you catch early interviews with me where I'm like, fans are going to...
Yes.
You know, early interviews, you know, you hear me going, you know, I think the fans are really going to appreciate it because it really is faithful. Like, you know, my original story took place mostly in an underground bunker and kept all the tropes and the ideas from the original one. And then if you catch later interviews with me, I'm like, it's a movie. Because they are distancing the hell out of yourself. They changed so much that it actually got to the point where I had to call my manager and say, I can't,
take my name off.
I didn't do that. Oh. I needed the residuals.
Okay,
but I'm like, I was like, you got to tell them I can't do anymore, because I said they've taken this so far away from what it was that the fans. I said the fans were going to kill us no matter how if we could have just completely just shot for shot remade the movie, and they would have still got mad. But I said now it's like. They should just call it something else.
Right. It's like, this is not the same.
So it's a fun, it's a, if you watch it, it's a fun zombie movie. Mm-hmm. It's not a good Day of the Dead remake because, and they shouldn't have called it that. And now they're remaking it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if 5 years later.
Now they run fast.
Yeah. Well, they ran fast in mine too, but they also climbed up on the ceilings and it was, anyway.
We're just changing rules everywhere. They can now climb up on the ceiling.
But,
okay.
But it's, you know, the funny thing is it's always, you know, with that movie, and you know, Tamara, you know, was my homage to Carrie that came out, and that movie got watered down a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, Lionsgate bought it originally to come out theatrically, and it just got watered down so much that when they saw it, they're like, "Yeah, we're not going to put this out theatrically.
Yeah, we'll put it out like direct
to video." And that was a lot of like budget stuff, and you know, some of the producers, not the main ones, like the Fishers were great, but there were some other producers that came on and kind of magically the budget kind of disappeared somewhere in the ether, and it had nothing to do with Lionsgate. This is like separately from them, and so, you know, the director didn't have a lot of money to shoot with, and then like a lot of the edgier scenes the actors, you know, like didn't want to do, and it just turned into this whole thing where it's a fun movie. I don't know if you've seen it, it's very like fun camp movie, but it was a lot darker and edgier originally, and
because that seems to be your regular style, is more darker, edgier, but people tend to futs with it a little bit.
They do, but you know
we
what?
Tend to write darker and edgier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the good thing is, and again, I learned to love all the movies for what they are, because you just have to at some point, you know, like, except for Return to Camp by the Lake. I'm just, that one is just like, oh, I can't. You know, there's a couple of actors and actors.
He gets the residual, he's like, rip.
There's
sunglasses on when that check
there's some talent. There's some talent in there that I like, you know, that have gone on, you know, gone on to do bigger things. So I can enjoy it for that. But it's just like that is the only movie that that I watch where I'm just like, because I don't even think the director wanted to do it. You know, it's just like, I think he was just pissed off. But you know, Day of the Dead is a fun zombie movie. If you take it kind of out of the milieu of that, and you know, again, they took stuff out that, you know, makes it make not sense. Like, you know, like all the younger characters are supposed to be in the reserves, not in the actual military. But they took that line out, so now it looks like Nick Cannon and Mina Savari and all these young people are like military, supposed to be like tough military people, and it's like, no, they were reservists.
Right.
So a little nitpicky things like that, but.
Right.
But I have to say, like, the stuff that I have going on now, I'm really excited about, because, you know, we just finished a movie in San Antonio that's about sleep paralysis called Dead Awake. And it took forever to get off the ground. But
because now you're dealing with stuff with that concept. You're dealing with stuff that, to me, can actually be scary because it's based on some real stuff that can happen. And
yeah, that's
just,
always your favorite thing. Oh my God. I'm a zombie dude myself, but this one loves...
When it's like real, like to the real, like that shit really happens, but you've like ramped it up to the point where it's become like this horrific thing. I love that.
And that's what we did with Dead... It's called Dead Awake, and it literally just wrapped last night. And, you know, that's one of those things where it's a concept where it's a real life concept, and there's a whole mythology behind it, and there's science behind it, and the story's about this woman who's investigating the death of somebody close to her who died of sleep paralysis, and as she starts digging into it and getting the people around her to kind of start believing in it, you realize that once you believe in it, this thing can come after you.
Damn it, those are the scary ones too.
Yeah, it turned out we got Joss and Donahue from House of the Devil and Insidious 2, and we got Jesse Bradford. We got Lori Petty.
Mm-hmm.
We got Bria Grant, who was in Halloween 2, and she was in Heroes. She was Speedy in Heroes, which I love. Jesse Borrego, who's been in a ton of stuff, but he was actually Jesse from Fame, the TV series, which actually makes me geek out.
That's funny.
Makes me geek out so much. So we got a good cast, and Philip Guzman is a director on it. Did a wonderful, like the stuff that I saw just looks mind-blowing. And we have some great, want to shout out to everybody, but you know, we have, you know, Derek Lee Nixon and James Lamar and Galen Walker, and Kurt Werman, and there's Philip, there's the last Philip that I'm forgetting his name, who's a producer on it too.
Hi, Philip.
And we just had a great team of producers who really pushed it to make this happen. And I think this movie is going to be, I was on set, I also shot like a role in it. And I think this movie is probably going to be, aside from anything that I direct, I think this movie is going to be the closest to my vision.
That's what I ask you. Like, is ever, this something that
this is something
where you see it?
Me and the director, like, completely meeting of the minds as far as everything, like, you know, and, you know, he called me up and he made some tweaks to the script, but everything he made just made the script better.
Right.
And
at least you guys talked about it.
Oh, yeah. You know and I mean? And I've been, I've actually had, except for the first film, I've actually had good relationships with every director that I've dealt with and the writers on the projects, too, of sequels. Like, I've had great relations. Like, because I, for me, it's all about collaboration. Like, that's a theater background in me. It's like collaboration. So I'm always able to kind of take my ego out of something to make a project better. Like, I don't, like, for me, it's like, if you come up with a great scene and my name's on the script as a screenwriter, that just makes me, that just makes me look better. You know, I'm just, to be honest.
That's true.
And so Philip really creatively just, you know, took what I had, made it his own, but also elevated it in a way. Like, there's stuff that I saw that he shot that is like way beyond what I had in my head. I'm like, this in it, you know.
I love that.
And so it's, I was so
excited.
That's what
your director should do.
Right.
They should take what you have on the page and expand on it in a whole another. You just saw the camera doing this and they went,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Absolutely.
So for this particular project, how did this idea come to you? Because it seems like you, your ideas are like kind of like how my ideas come. Like, something happens, you're like, God damn
it. Well, this one actually, some producers actually brought some articles to me on sleep paralysis. And so then I just started, you know, doing research into like the history of sleep paralysis and the mythology of it. And, you know, again, in your brain, you got to come up with rules and why is this happening to certain people. And I don't want to give anything away plot wise.
Right.
That started off just some articles. But then once I started reading all the mythology, I started seeing like ways that you could really make this. Plus, it's interesting that there was this Hmong study about these people who came from a country, and I should have Googled this before I came over here, because I don't want to be racist and lump people together. But it was, I think it was from a Vietnamese people, but it was a group called the Hmong. It was the actual group of people, and they all came over and they all died in their sleep within a period of being here for like a couple of years.
Oh my God, that's scary! And, what was the reason?
And they don't know, but they all reported seeing this thing sitting on their chest.
Shut up. You know what?
That's a mythology.
Because you know what? Here's my thing. I've actually, well, my what I understand for sleep paralysis, sometimes isn't it the concept of that you can go to sleep and sometimes you'll wake up before your body really has, so you're kind of awake.
Yep.
But so the like body doesn't move. Because there's times where I've woken up I've woken up literally where I've tried to like scream.
Yeah, and you can't
and
move.
You can't do nothing. Yes. And then it slowly kind of fades out and it, you know, I used to think that it was like alien invasions when I was a kid. See, when it would happen to me. Like, this is how they get you.
A lot one in three people will experience it in their lifetime. And the thing is, it's but your brain shuts your body down when you go to sleep at night so you don't act out your dreams.
Right.
And then a lot of times you'll wake up and the brain hasn't turned the body on.
Like my brain be like, bitch, what are you doing? Like, this is not the time.
So people think that alien abduction, they think that that's a lot of the reasons that people because a lot of people experience like evil and they all say the same thing. There's something evil in the room with them holding them down.
Because you
something's
said that
on something's on their chest. Something's on their chest.
And you can't move.
So, so it's just a fascinating mythology behind it. And, you know, that's one of those ideas where it's like, okay, this is an obvious franchise, I think, that will tap into something that...
That's subconsciously the universal experience of people and sleep. And I love that kind of shit. Why are you so smart with your stuff? My God.
No, well, you know, I try to come up with concepts. It's like, and we have another, I'm not going to sit here and like pimp all my projects, but there's another project that I directed
a short.
50,000 listeners out there.
I directed a short.
You don't like this redhead? I got this brunette right here. You like this brunette? I got this ombre colored chick right here. Come on. You want like that? I got something over here. Come on now.
But it's like, well, it's like, it's more speaks, I think, to the concepts, because I think in horror, concept is kind of king. Like, you can sell it. People go to see a movie because of the concept, not necessarily stars. And I directed my first short.
Can you say that one more again?
People go to see horror movies based on the concept and not stars.
So stop trying to put people in here and pimping people that you think is like, we need good story. We just need a good, freaking good story. For example, It Follows, there was nobody in there.
And it's so funny. And that's the frustrating thing is like, I did once, I was dealing with an investor trying to get financing for a feature, and This was the one. And we sent her, I sent over a list of all the top, like, 20, 30 horror films that had come out in the last 2 years. And out of the top 10, only three of them had stars. And this other 15 in the top 15 didn't. Mm-hmm. And then the movies that had the biggest stars in them weren't in the top 20.
They made the worst. Exactly. And because you cannot relate to them. People like to see people they don't know because it makes the shit more real.
That's why Paranormal Activity
when you have, when you have famous people in it, we get sidetracked. Like, oh, this is a celebrity pretending you to know be somebody. Yeah. And it's like, and since they're the star... chances are nothing too bad is going to happen.
You know, they don't survive.
Yeah, it's like, it's in their contract. Right. You know?
And then, the distributors, but the distributors want to have names.
Because they think that's going to sell overseas.
Yeah. I know, it's so frustrating.
I need to get in distribution and just wreck shit up.
I know. Like, it gets really frustrating when you're trying to do that. So, but with Good Samaritan, you know, the concept is these people witness somebody being assaulted in a park and nobody helps the person out.
I saw the trailer. Oh, it's scary.
And, well, that's the short I did. I did a short, but we have a feature version that we're working on.
Well, I think it's the short trailer. The short trailer. Yeah.
And so nobody helps them, but somebody videotapes it and outs the witnesses. And so they start dying off and you're not sure if it's the guy's spirit or if it's like karma or if it's a killer that's after them. So you don't know until the end, like what's after these people. Mm-hmm. And so that
went to a lot of film festivals. It
went to a lot of film festivals. We're actually putting it out next month. We'll know the exact date within the next week. Cause we're going to put it up online, for free, but people can donate anything if they want
that's
to,
really cool.
if they want, just because, you know, to help fund some future stuff, but also help get our investors some back. But if you donate over $1, you'll get like a behind the scenes thing that we've put together.
I'm gonna donate $10 so I can get the behind the scenes extras.
It's only $1 if you want it, the behind the scenes extras, but it's free to, it'll be free to watch.
I can't donate $10
before you walk out.
you can do it everyone. But the thing is, what we wanted to do is we wanted to obviously make the short available for everybody, but also because, you know, it is a business, people did invest in the film, and we also want to make more stuff.
Right.
It's like, well, you know, we'll give you the option if you want, even if you just want to donate, like, you know, 15 cents or 10 cents or whatever, a cup of coffee, you know, it's not, but we figured we'd do something special for the people who did over $1.
Right.
And so we put together a really nice behind the scenes packet.
Y'all been really
and
nice.
And here's the thing.
Usually it's like $10 or more, and then the $1.
It's smart. And also because a lot of times really good stuff, honestly, a lot of good stuff nowadays, it's word of mouth. Like, especially in the, just talking specifically with the horror genre. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of the great stuff, especially a lot of people who are putting their shorts up that later become movies. Like Mama, I think a couple years back, I'm trying to remember the name of the movie, but it was a horror, The Tooth Fairy, and some other things that later became something else that became like Dark Falls or something like that, or When Darkness Falls. And, you know, a lot of big directors are looking for people who have stuff that's interesting and different and unique. And I'm always online. Like a lot of times, once a month, I guarantee you, I will be sitting up on a Saturday and I will binge watch shorts, horror shorts, looking for, and I'm looking for names for people, like directors, writers, so that if something new comes out, I'm looking out for them because I want to see their stuff. Okay. And the fact that you guys are making it so easy and so affordable to be able to like watch this stuff and support at the same time, I think it's really smart.
Yeah. Well, it's free if you want, and it's free, and if you want to put anything in, it's not. And,
can I ask you a question?
Of course.
So you directed, was that your first thing you directed?
It was the first thing I directed. And the funny thing is,
what made that happen? Had it been in a back mind? Had you directed in college?
It's a lot of it was having, you know, scripts that started off really good and then didn't turn out quite like I wanted them to. And I'm like, you know what, there are a couple of stories that I have. There are three, actually. One's Superstition, one is Good Samaritan, and the other one's called The Horror Show. And there are three scripts that I have that I know that I just don't want anybody mucking up. You know what I'm saying?
And so I
directed the short because everybody's like, well, you need to have something to show. So I directed the short.
Some sort of a concept.
Then you could actually do it. Yeah. Like, you know.
And the short was amazing. We got Rainn Wilson to be in it.
Yes.
And Toby Hemingway, who was in The Covenant and he was in Black Swan. He's a wonderful actor and he's wonderful young actor. And the person that I'm most excited about, I always geek out about this. So from my childhood, there were two pinnacle shows. There was the movie Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yes.
And there was a miniseries V. For my short, I had like, there's like a little cameo, and I was like, well, I've met Heather Langenkamp.
Did you?
And I was like, I could get her, but nobody has seen, would expect Jane Badler, who played Diana, to be anything. So I got Jane Badler to be in my short.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
And literally, I have to say,
that's awesome.
I have to say, I've never, and I, when I worked at New Line, like, I met like Morgan Freeman and Brad Pitt. I met like A-list people, like, at, just at parties and stuff. Never got starstruck because I knew how to keep my professional. I went out to lunch with Jane Badler, and I'm literally sitting here and can't talk.
No, like, that shit is real,
and
y'all.
I never knew what it was like to be starstruck. Like, I never in my life. And here, this was like 2 years ago. I'm sitting with her, and I'm just trying to talk. And in my head, I'm just thinking, you know, because me and my friends used to – me and my friend Greg used to – Greg Slows from high school, we used to get in these – Lydia and Diana fights at school. And I was always Diana, of course.
Yes.
So I'm just sitting there, and finally there was a point, like 5 minutes in, where I'm like, I said, I really have to apologize. I said, I really just need to kind of sit back for a second because I'm really having speechless
a moment
right now.
I'm having a moment. And yes.
I really can't deal with this right now. That I'm talking to you. The sweetest woman. She is amazing, and I can't wait to like actually work with her like on something else, because
I love that.
But so that was actually, I mean, and I love Rainn Wilson and Toby Hemingway too. Like, no, I'm,
and
but,
it was really good to see Rainn Wilson. You know, a lot of times people see him funny stuff, like, but to see him in serious stuff or just something where it's like, oh wow.
See, people who are funny like that usually can play straight.
Yeah,
right.
Robin Williams, I mean, Jim Carrey, they can do it in a
And he does a great job, and he's amazing talent, and so the short turned out really, you know, we got some really good talent and a really good team. I had a really
it
good
looks
team.
Good.
Really
it
good
really
team
does.
Around me.
And what did you guys shoot that on? What was it?
The Sony my DP is going to.
So it wasn't like a Red or something. It was like a.
It was a Sony.
It was Sony.
Let's just say.
But it looked nice. I mean, it looked like a.
Yeah,
red
let's just
camera.
Say it looked good. Yeah, because I know this. I wasn't expecting that question.
That's okay. I'm throw you on the spot.
But
I kind of did, but.
But I. but no, I mean it turned out really well, and
Have your agents and managers seen it? Have they?
Oh no, yeah, no, and what's going on right now is I'm working with this producer Andrew Vandenhouten, who's done a lot of great stuff. He did a lot of Jet Ketchum's projects, early projects. He did just finished a movie called All Cheerleaders Must Die.
Because they got to.
Because they got to. Are All Cheerleaders Die? I'm sorry. I think they I think they took the must out of it.
Okay.
Like something Scotty Mullen would.
Yeah, I was like.
but he's a great producer. So right now we're working on the feature version of it.
Oh, nice.
And so we're really excited about that. We're teaming up with some really good people to make that happen. So I'm really excited about that. So that'll be, you know, hopefully going forward next year. Okay. You know,
what,
I mentioned
about TV-wise.
TV-wise, I have a project out right now. I'm trying to think if I can talk about it. I think I can talk about it. I have two projects out right now. I have one called Near Death that Elizabeth Devine, who's one of the showrunners and executive producers of CSI, worked on with me and a friend of mine named David Sporn out of New York, and it's kind of like people investigating demons that are coming into our world through people's near-death experiences.
Love it.
So we're out with that show right now, and I'm working with
I know some writers.
No,
we eat that stuff up.
And I'm working on another show called The Guardians with my producers and managers at Convergence Entertainment, which is kind of like a Buffy, but where everybody has paranormal power, or X-Men, where everybody has paranormal powers.
Yeah.
And
that's our concept.
Yeah, I'm excited about that one. And
well, I'm glad that you're bringing back the paranormal, supernatural stuff back into the
show. You know, I love
that. You'd like to interwove, what's the word?
Interweave. We don't have that word in the project. I'm excited about that. And then I'm also working on this project about H.H. Holmes, America's First Serial Killer. So I'm really excited about that.
Okay.
And we have a pilot out, and we're out with that right now. I think I can talk about it.
Look at you. You're doing a lot of stuff.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. And the funny thing is, because you have to stay busy, and the I feel very blessed. It's been, you know, it's been a rough year for me this last year because my mom passed in February. You know, we were very close, and my sister was, you know, her primary caregiver in Kentucky, and it was a really rough year, and then and it feels like, you know, it kind of feels like right now she's kind of like looking out for me, and like, because it just feels like a lot of things are starting to percolate right now, like, you know, I've got, with Andrew, I've got this project called The Undertakers too. That's like a YA book. It's an alien invasion.
Nice.
It's an alien invasion, but the aliens are made of energy, so they use zombies or use corpses as hosts. So it's as, almost
you
a zombie.
Up, you write up his alligator.
It's like The Maze Runners meets Walking Dead. It's a friggin' great YA book, and we're moving forward on that, and we're moving forward on Good Samaritan. I'm moving forward with Superstition, with this company called Global Renaissance, whose goal is to like do multicultural films.
Yeah.
Really? That really, yeah, that
so
are
make
global.
Sure writers, make sure you check those folks out.
Yeah, they're shout really really good company. Mm. And so yeah, we're doing a project called Superstition right now that kind of plays on the superstition that deaths occur in threes. So it's set on a college campus where two people have died, and going under the superstition that death occurs in threes, somebody starts a Deadpool on the internet to figure out who's
going
to
be next.
An app.
Yeah.
And what happens is somebody picks the somebody who ends up dying, and then somebody starts using the app because now they have access to all the students' phones with these apps, starts going through people on the list, and so it's kind of a whodunit, you know, kind of a...
I like that, the mystery element of trying to figure out.
And our lead character basically finds out that she, you know, people around her are dying, and the clues are starting to point to her, so she starts realizing there's somebody out there that has a vendetta against her. So it's a really fun, like, because there hasn't been a... We haven't had a... I can't think of an original slasher film. I shouldn't say that because somebody's going to write me on Twitter or something and bitch at me. See, you didn't see this one. But I think theatrically, I can't think of a slasher film that's not been a sequel.
DVD or something.
Think of a theatrical slasher film.
One of the most
film.
Recent ones I've just, it's not even that, I don't know, I think it was last year or not that recent, but I just saw it on Netflix and I thought it was pretty good was I Saw the Devil, which was a Korean.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that was a, that was a slasher?
It can be considered kind of because it's more gore.
Was that the one where the guy wanted revenge against the...
Who killed his fiancée.
Right.
And he's a...
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, he's coming and he's punishing the guy. Instead of turning him in, he's revisiting back revenge.
Yeah, that's
so it's like revenge slasher. It's out there. It's not everybody's cup of tea. I don't recommend it for everybody.
It's a little intense, but it's a really
intense,
good movie.
But if you survived Audition...
Oh, yeah.
True.
You can survive this, okay? But I want, really quickly, before we start wrapping up, I wanted to go through, because one of the things I really love about horror is the psychology behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So, just for the speaking audience, because I want to ask you something that's personal, because it's something I'm still grappling with, trying to figure out why I love the genre so much.
Mm-hmm.
So, the first thing I want to let the audience know, there was a psychologist, Glenn Walters, who said there were three factors why people like to go see horror. Number one, the tension.
Okay.
The mystery, suspense, gore, the terror, that kind of thing, and the release of that when at the end when you're like kind of pleased. The other thing is the relevance.
What do you mean when you say the relevance?
Relevance in terms of, is it relevant to the viewer? Like, is it a universal story? Is it something that people can relate to? For example, death or the unknown. That's why people love Final Destination, because it was like death is like, and everybody's going to face death. Bitches, you ain't not gonna get out of this world. And if death is the enemy, how's that gonna work out? And everybody can relate to that because everyone's gonna die. They just don't want to die right away. Also, when you're dealing with an unknown, I love shit that's with the unknown. I think that's why It Follows really affected me, because we didn't know really what it was, and it was unknown. It was something new. And also cultural, like subgroups, teens, you know, teenagers and things. Do people relate to things? Like, I think the last Paranoia Activity last year was with the Latino community, which is really, really fun.
And really well done,
and
too.
And really like, well really done. Am. And the audience who went, like, where I live, it's, like, predominantly, it's Black and Latino. And so it was fantastic to watch, because it was like, oh, my God, that's us up there on the screen. What is going on? So that terms of relevance. And also the concept of unrealism. Yeah. This is what he said, which is basically, we know shit is not real. Therefore, we can enjoy it and watch it, knowing that nothing's going to happen to us. So it's kind of like a cathartic release to watch it, and kind of, for me, it's kind of like, I'm going to watch it, like, if shit really does go down, at least I'm going to know what not to do.
Oh, yeah.
In that situation.
I knew how to get out of my house, you know? And kill a kid.
Yeah. You know, and the unrealness is mitigated by factors and by the use of multiple angle shots in the films, music, also the idea of dark humor, that kind of thing. Because what this psychologist said is, people can watch really horrible horror movies, and he did a study, but when you show them shit that was real life stuff that happens, people can't really handle that kind of stuff. And I can relate to this, because I remember one time, sometimes I go to goth clubs when they have, during Halloween, they have goth party stuff and
sometimes
go in, and sometimes they'll have, like, you know, some parties they'll show things on the screen, and somebody was playing like Faces of Death kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it took me a long time to watch Faces, even though I got through and it wasn't as bad as I thought, but the uncomfortness, because it was real.
Yes.
made it, oh God, I can't deal with that mm-hmm. stuff.
Yeah.
But I can sit there and watch Audition and everything else mm-hmm. and stuff being cut up, and I'd be like, oh my God,
yeah.
that's really gross. Mm-hmm. Let me see what else is going to happen, yeah. that kind of thing. So for you, my question for you, because these are, like he said, these are the factors that we get when we go see these movies. But what I'm curious knowing is, why do you think we're attracted to horror? In particular, why were you attracted? Because not everybody likes it.
True.
Like, when I was growing up, my mom took us, like, I swear to God, my first movie ever at two mm-hmm. was Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my and God, that, I remember that. I can't believe you know that movie. That
and Drive-In with Moms and two.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, my mother's excuse is always, well, you were supposed to have been, because we didn't have babysitters back in the day, you're supposed to have been sleeping in the back of the car.
and
that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. And so that movie, we're like,
she up like this, peeking behind her.
Two, okay, a toddler. And like, it, I don't know if it was, you know how they talk about certain animals imprint? Like, that was imprinted on me, as opposed to watching shows where, oh, the happy stuff that they think kids are supposed to be watching. Mm-hmm. I've always been attracted to horror, like books. Mm-hmm. In mythology, I'm looking for the darker stories. Like, mm-hmm. what about the bitches that go down to Hades and stuff? Let's talk about that stuff. I know there's, you know, there's fauns and, oh, yeah, there's fairies and all that. But what about the bitches that get stuck in hell, that kind of stuff? For me, when you talk about books in the Bible at church, I'm like, let's get to Revelations, because that seems to be most interesting.
That's the good shit.
That's the good shit. Like, show me the demons and all that shit going down. Like,
yeah.
Noah and the ark and all that. Yeah. But let's get to the shit where the second, you know.
Exactly.
There's something to it, and I'm still grappling with that mm-hmm. speaks to me. Mm-hmm. What is it that attracts you? Since most of your work is dealing with horror and the horrific natures of humanity, I guess.
I mean, for me, just to be completely honest, I think for me, being gay and also being a minority growing up, you know, I experienced just a lot of prejudice.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, you know, like the kind of prejudice where people would, like, spit on us or throw rocks at us mm-hmm. and, you know, just stuff like, you know, things mm-hmm. like that. So for me, horror was always kind of an escape in a way, because it, mm-hmm. it did let me kind of deal with a lot of those angry feelings and kind of vent. And, you know, kind of the subtext of a lot of the horror films in the early days was like the unpopular kid was the one who ended up surviving
right.
and the popular kids were the ones who didn't.
Right.
And so for me, I think that helped me deal with a lot of the ugliness that I saw mm-hmm. and experienced growing up. And this was like, I mean, and again, I always, you know, I'm always mindful of the fact, you know, again, I'm very proud of where I grew up. Mm. My mom's white, and she moved back there to take care of her parents. And we faced, and I, you know, mentioned this, and we faced a lot of prejudice.
Mm.
And, you know, my mom always taught me, you know, I'm a Baha'i. That's the religion I was born into. And one of the major tenets is that all races are equal and that, you know, genders are equal and, you know, things like that. So I was always brought up very colorblind in that the races were very, you know, equal. And my mom married a black man before the civil rights movement. I mean, she was way ahead of her time.
Mm-hmm.
And so my mom always just taught me that they didn't know any better. And not that they were not putting anybody down. She's just like, they haven't experienced black people before. So they are only going off the misconceptions that they were brought up with.
Yeah, ignorance.
And it's also the concept of othering to the other and mm-hmm. people being scared of the other,
right?
You know? Mm-hmm.
And you know, so I, you know, that's why it, even today, you know, it gets very, you know, when you talk about gay rights and especially when African Americans say we don't want you to say that the gay rights movement is a civil rights movement. It's like, well, just to be honest, you know, the people that called me nigger growing up were the same people that were calling me faggot once mm-hmm. calling me nigger wasn't exactly. cool anymore.
Right.
You know,
right.
like there was a demarcation line where up until a certain age, I was the nigger at school.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, it was like, well, once people started really going, hey, that's not cool anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Then the really mm-hmm. prejudiced people were like, well, then they started calling me faggot.
That's mm-hmm. when you started, you know, to intersections. Mm-hmm.
So it's like, you know, all that prejudice, no matter how you want to justify it, kind of comes from the same place. So for me, horror films were an escape. I hate real life violence
yes.
in the same way I can't watch real life violence.
Yeah.
But that's why I sparked movies like, you know, Carrie
yes.
or, you know, growing up or
you just want to have superhuman powers and knock somebody out.
I know. I want
to knock the bitch out.
I want telekinesis. I want telekinesis so bad. You know, you have no idea how bad I want telekinesis.
Is that the superhuman power you'd have if you could have superhuman power?
I think it would be, because Storm's my favorite superhero, but it was like, would you want to control the weather or have telekinesis? And in my dreams, I'm always Storm. Like I don't turn into Storm.
Right, right.
But I'm always controlling the weather and making tornadoes
right,
and stuff
that's
like that.
Right.
So, but
see, I'm always like Blade in mine.
Mm. Yeah.
I always have zombie or vampire dreams. That's
right.
That's it.
Yeah, so I would I don't know if I'd want to control the weather or telekinesis would be cool. Mm. Either one of them. Mm-hmm. Either one of them. Mm-hmm. But getting back to the root of that, I think that horror kind of allowed me to process a lot of there was violence too, yeah. Around me, and just process it and kind of let it go because I'm surprisingly I understand where a lot of people that have gone through that are very angry. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I've met a lot of white people who grew up in predominantly Black and Latino areas who were treated poorly.
Sure.
And they still hold on to that. You know, mm-hmm. they're still very prejudiced now against that. And mm-hmm. it's like, I think it's mostly because of my religious beliefs, but also because of the way my mom raised me, that I was kind of able to kind of let that stuff go and realize like, you know, and I'm best friends with a lot of these people today. You know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? These people, they just didn't know any better growing up. Sure. And so the irony is I've gotten so many messages from people I went to high school with who are like, I just want you to know I married a Black man, and if I hadn't met you, I don't think I would have. Yeah. And I'm like, well, good for you. You know,
not
and
they, having children who look just like
and,
you.
I know, and I actually think that's a great, wonderful thing to hear because again, mm-hmm. they were saying like because I met you and got to know you as a person,
right?
I was able to put aside the prejudices that my parents taught me, mm-hmm. and have moved forward, mm-hmm. and that's all that we can hope for in the world in general. But again, for me, hanging on to anger and resentment about any of that stuff. Like, that's why I'm always honest about how I grew up because I don't want to whitewash it. Mm-hmm. You know, and then there's a part of me in the back of my head. It's like, I don't want people back home thinking I'm talking shit about them because I'm not.
Right.
Because that was a sign of the times.
Yeah, you were just real taught, this is what happened. It is what it is.
And things have changed and mm-hmm. people have changed backward. It's so funny. Like, I used to, when I went home all the time, back in the old days, people would follow, you know, just typical follow you around the stores to make sure mm-hmm. and it gets annoying, or the cops would always pull you over, and it's like, ugh. But now I go back, and there's, you know, in my hometown, there's like a Chinese restaurant with a Chinese family that runs it.
Oh, really?
And it's so funny because they have the hillbilly accents like I do.
it's like in New Orleans. You go down there and you get your food.
It's funny.
Yeah.
I have a new show that I'm working on, and it takes place in the South. And there's two Asian characters who have Southern accents.
Yeah.
It's very funny.
And then I go back and I'll see an interracial couple or a Black couple, and I'm like, nobody's staring at them. You know, mm-hmm. which is great. It's a good mm-hmm. thing. But there's still that one, there's a little tiny bit of part of me that when I used to go home, that would be like, if I went to a store that wasn't like where everybody knew me, mm-hmm. I was, you know, there's like, are they going to start following me? Are they going to do this? Or here comes a cop pulling me over again. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, so it's for me, again, the horror is real life horror is what worries me. That, you know, whether it's violence, whether it's prejudice, you know, mm-hmm. I think prejudice is a general thing is probably the worst thing that happened in the world for whatever reason, whether you're prejudiced against gay people, whether you're prejudiced against white people, mm-hmm. whether you're prejudiced against religious people mm-hmm. or people who aren't religious, mm-hmm. like people don't seem to understand, like, you know, it's, it all goes to everybody. Like, you know, if you start hating on other people, it's just a cycle. And for
and
some
everything
reason,
is interconnected. People don't seem to realize that. Like,
people don't seem to realize, like, we all came, whether science or religion, we mm-hmm. all came from the same place. Like, mm-hmm. if you're going by science, then we all evolved from the same thing. If you're going by religion, yeah, we all started with Adam
right,
and Eve.
Right.
Like, you know what? No matter how you look at it, like, you know, kind of society kind of functions by keeping us divided because right. it's easier to, like,
true.
You know, to turn us against each other, because then we can't just sit down and have a conversation about, like, you know, it's like, just I'll just throw race out there just to play the race card for a minute. I'm not playing the race card. I don't have my deck of cards with me. But the thing is about race is, like, we can't have a civil conversation almost because it's been framed by mostly politicians mm-hmm. and the media, where on one side, people of color are being told that racism is a thing of the past that we should just get over. And it's like, well, I was being spit on and had thrown rocks thrown at me when I was in high school. That wasn't that long ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there were still schools segregated in 69 when I was born. Mm-hmm. So that stuff, you know, it takes generations to breed prejudice out of people.
Right.
You can't just pass a law and then all of a sudden people aren't prejudiced anymore.
Right.
But on the same side, I know a lot of my friends who are white feel, for some reason, and again, that's where I think the dialogue has to be massaged, is they feel like they're being blamed personally for the prejudice. But
especially in Hollywood.
But yeah.
Especially, you know,
in Hollywood. I'm being blamed. Like, yeah. No, but it's just, you're just benefiting some things that happened long ago. Right. We're just pointing it out to you gently. Exactly.
Right. But
so you can understand why some things happen, and you just need to, like, grow up and...
Right.
Get with the program.
But the thing is, a lot of...
Get with the winning team, ho. Come
on. Right. But there is a way... Sometimes there's a... And for me, it's all about how things are presented in conversations, but there are a lot of white people who are made to feel like, again, they're personally being blamed right now for things that they didn't do. And when I talk to them, I'm like, you know what? It's like, okay, I'm gay and a minority. So... But we talk about
exactly.
even as a gay minority male, I still have certain privileges that right. a woman doesn't have.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? That doesn't mean that I should be ashamed that I'm a man, or that I'm a bad person because I'm a man, or that I'm doing something wrong personally. Mm-hmm. But I know that women who have taken jobs that I've left have gotten paid less than me, even though I'm a gay minority.
Right. Okay. Right.
I know that if I go walking down the street at night, I don't have to worry about somebody raping me. Mm-hmm. Like, there are just certain things as a man that are privileges bestowed upon me for just having a penis.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, and so when I try to explain it to them that way, then it takes a little of the sting out.
Right.
But I don't think people have the conversation in a way where we're bringing everybody to the table to try to figure out a solution. It's all about, you know, it's all about, well, you're just playing the race card, or this is this and this, you know, and it's like, there's so much screaming and yelling and it makes for good, you know, it makes for good Donald Trump speeches you know, and book sales.
It's just that ridiculous fear. And it's like, look, look, white people, slavery happened.
Because they always have to say, well, and, you know, you have Obama, you have Kobe Bryant, you have...
Let's just
called the exception.
Yes.
They always allow one or two of us in.
Yes. Well, if you talk about it, then we ain't got to talk about it that much. Like, look, it's just deal with it. Shit happened. What are we going to do to move forward?
To move forward, absolutely. And the thing with Obama, you know, just bring him up for a second, like... It's not like the whole country voted for him. It's like most of the country doesn't even vote.
Right.
So we're talking about out of the small portion of the population that
actually
did vote.
He
got the majority vote out of that part. So it's not like the whole country voted him into the White House and everything's changed.
Because seriously, if you really just did not want Obama, for those folk who don't like colored folk, y'all could have came out and voted. And I mean, you are like the majority population for right now.
Yeah.
You know, y'all clearly could have cut him a mass and like shut that shit down. Clearly, there is a disconnect from those people who have this fear, those particular white people, the people who are white who are like, you know what? That shit's old. It's played out. We're making something new.
True.
You know, so, you know, get over it.
So let's wrap this up. But let me just ask you one question that I've been asking a lot of our guests lately. Which is, if you came to town now, and you probably have been answered this question before, but I'd just like for my audience to hear this. If you came to town today with, say, a script or two, what would you do differently knowing what you know now?
Right. What would be different?
I had such a weird experience just because of the whole starting off at New Line thing. If I came to, what I tell people now is, if there's a way that you can make your script into a movie, like even if it's a short... You know, you can shoot stuff on iPhones now that are getting distributed online. You can connect with other filmmakers who are looking for scripts to write. Like there's a group that I'm with, Andrew Van Houten, that I help out with called Tent Square, TENTSquare.com, and it's basically like a social media site for filmmakers. It's free. You just create a profile. You can upload your stuff. They have competitions all the time with like cash prizes and stuff like that, but you can connect with filmmakers. So if you're a writer, you can connect with a director who's like, hey, I'm looking for a script to shoot. You know, find a tribe and start making stuff happen. Because the thing is, if you come out here, a lot of times people come out here and they're like, well, I've got to get my script sold to a studio. If you look at what the studios are putting out, most of it's remakes, sequels, stuff based on comics, stuff based on books, stuff based on video games now. They're not looking for original content. So you've got to figure out how to get your stuff that represents your voice out there. So as a screenwriter, you can enter some contests, but I think the goal is to get your film made. And so write stuff that's not crazy budget-wise, you know. And again, ideally, if you can find like you know, a director who's looking for stuff, like try to connect, even if it's starting off small, like, okay, well, let's do it like with Good Samaritan, like let's do a short version of the feature that I want to make. So that way people can
proof of concept.
So that's the advice that I would say, you know, I went to the LA High School Film Student Awards to give out like their horror award. And some of those kids were at Cannes.
Oh, really?
The high school. This is high school. High school kids. Huh. They're like, well, our other teammates couldn't be here because they're over in France right now. Okay. I think it's where Con is. But some of the stuff that I saw was amazing. And these kids shot this stuff on iPhones or they shot it on, like, you know.
5Ds.
Yeah. And so the access to equipment is out there now where you can shoot something a lot cheaper. I would say try to get something shot, even if you're just a writer, you know, get something shot to show, you know, to kind of proof of your concept,
right.
You know, because there's no, the old way of kind of like the old studio system's dead, you know, it just doesn't work. That's like true. It, you know, they don't have the, you know, they don't have the, I mean, some of them have their, but you know, used to, you'd submit your script to a studio, you'd submit a query letter, they'd have a reader cover it. If it got good coverage, they'd pass it around. They don't do that. They're too busy now on their comic book franchises and their book franchises.
We got to acquire the next thing. Mean,
that's all I do now. You know, people hire me to produce their projects so we can shoot the concept, so we can shoot the pilot, so we can shoot whatever.
Right.
Because everybody has, I'll give you 20 minutes to watch something.
Right.
You know, watch your first 23 minutes or whatever, but I don't have time to read an hour and a half script.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's happening all the time. But that's something that I thank you very much. That was very good advice. You know, it's just all about being your own boss, taking control of your career.
Yeah.
Not waiting, but as Lisa always says,
not waiting.
Right, though.
Right.
And you have to, have to be ready to dedicate 10 years of your life. To it, you know, because the thing is, there's so much clutter out here as far as people coming out with their 1 year or 2 year plans. So you got those people coming out every day, you know, 50-100 people come in here every day with a 2 year plan.
You gotta be that marathon runner.
They're cluttering up the marketplace because they're coming out here with like 5 scripts. And so you've got to pace yourself and you got to, you know, do the work and keep yourself going somehow, you know. And not saying it'll take 10 years, but for every one of those overnight success stories, you know.
You got to be ready for the 10-year
run. You got to be ready for the 10-year run. Understood. You know? So.
Well, on that note, thank you so much, Jeffrey. We appreciate it. We've been trying to get you on for a minute. So thank you. Cal, where can people find you? You're on Twitter?
Twitter's the best. So it's Jeffrey A. Reddick, and that's the best way to just kind of keep track with what's going on.
Are you on there a lot?
I'm starting to be. Like, it's so funny. I joined like years ago, and then I didn't start actually really getting involved in Twitter till last year when I did the short. But I do check it every day now, and I try to update stuff. And
like I was telling Lisa offline before we started, you gotta do Final Destination. Maybe you do part two since that's his favorite one. And get him on.
I know for the fight, like Friday Night Horror is like, let me talk to Graveyard Shift Sister and be like, hey, I have to check. They might have done it.
I don't know.
Let me check to see, because that would be kind of fun, because then we could just have you come and live tweet with us. It's so much fun. Because we watch it, like we watch it all over the world. And we sit there, and as we're watching it, we have a hashtag for it, and we just conversate as it's going on.
That's awesome.
Hilarious.
That sounds awesome.
It's so much fun.
Oh, my God. That sounds like so much fun.
It's so much fun.
Cool. Where are you at, Lisa Colton?
Y'all know where I am. You can find me on Twitter. And also at BitchFlix.
I like it. You throw that
out. You can find me on Twitter, at Church, and on BitchFlix. BitchFlix. Yes, where I write a lot of film reviews with the feminist slant, because you know I'm all about intersections, people. And you can go on there and read my latest piece about Straight Outta Compton movie. And but I'm always there. But you can always, I'm always lurking, usually on Saturday nights. On Saturday Night Sci-Fi. Ooh. Shout again to Geek Soul Brother.
Geek Soul.
And the whole tribe of folks
Black
out there
girl
who,
nerds.
Cause last night, you know, last night they did Firefly. What was it? Firefly?
How did you do that?
And they did like the TV show. They did the first two episodes. I was busy and I didn't get a chance to, but I missed that. But it's always fun.
I was watching Narcos last night.
Oh, how was it? I saw it on Netflix. I'm like,
I was watching the opening of Scream like 5 times in a row.
Are you really?
Yes. I just, because Drew Barrymore is so good in that. Like the fear, like, anyway, we'll talk later, girl.
Yes.
Well, we did an episode earlier this year about horror. So we're gonna keep talking about doing another one closer to
Halloween.
Halloween. So maybe we'll try to have you back and we can just talk about it.
Because I would like to really talk more, because I had some other questions. But I want to say, because I realized, and I was thinking, I was like, no, we need to have you come back again.
Yeah, we need to
Because we need to break down. Because I think it's important that people realize that horror is not dead. It is alive and well. The good stuff is coming from indie folks.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And we need to have that serious conversation, because we need to change how horror movies are being disrespected and considered less than,
it's always been like that.
We're
and
like
it's so
the redhead stepchild in the basement. I know what we are,
but we make money. It's like we're the redhead stepchildren that make money. Mm-hmm. And I love redheads, by the way, too. Just FYI, just
all my redheads. Just all man, I love gingers.
And I am your host, Hilliard Guest, and you guys can find me on Twitter at Hilliard Guest. I say Twitter like I'm cool.
Twitter.
And you guys can follow the show at Screenwriters RR, because Rant Room is too long, so they abbreviate it, because Twitter ain't cool yet. I said it.
Now you're banned from Twitter.
I wish they would. Our next guest is coming. Scotch. What's up, buddy?
Wonderful Scotch.
So you guys know how we do it on the Rant Room. I got to give a special shout out to my man, Jack Spade. He's got some kick-ass hip-hop music that he's been making for us. He's making a cool-ass theme song for us, by the way.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we have one now, but he's making a new one for us. So that's coming out soon. And then a couple quick countries, England, Japan, France, Germany, Australia, Brazil. I'm going to give it just to y'all a quick five right there. Thank you very much. You guys know who you are. So, you're going to join in with us when we say 2015.
I'm going to take this burrito right now.
All right.
Me too. You're going to join in us when we say 2015. Just listen.
In English?
Well, damn it. Ain't we speaking in English?
Scotch is like, I know five languages.
You want to keep it simple.
So, y'all know how we do it on the Rant Room. Mm-hmm. On this show, we keep it street. We keep it opinionated. We keep it what?
2015.
Peace, y'all.
Peace.
I am not the enemy. Dear Mr. Officer, why your gun off safety? You aim and shoot with no regard. Will I make it home to my family? If the tables were turned, you wouldn't like that. How much are we supposed to take until we fight back? You must correct this mistake to see the right track. You won't be sealing my fate, I want my life back. I know I fit the profile because the color of my skin. It's been known for a while, ain't no need to pretend. Even if you white and dressed like a nigga, Johnny Law still at you with his finger on the trigger. I'm just trying to reach success and live my life to the fullest. How the hell can I do that if I'm steady dodging the bullets from the people who were sworn to protect? Don't try my intellect, only those that give respect deserve to keep respect, and I suspect you was never respected. Now your power tripping, but your anger's misdirected. Trying to be a hero, well, you a villain in my eyes. I put my hands to the sky, live free or die.
Dear Mr. Officer, why do you hate me? I am not a criminal, I am not the enemy. Dear Mr. Officer, why your gun off safety? You aim and shoot with no regard. Will I make it home to my family? Dear Mr. Officer, why do you hate me? I am not a criminal, I am not the enemy. Dear Mr. Officer, why your gun off safety? You aim and shoot with no regard. Will I make it home to my family?